Excellent song.
Well, I don't know. Ryan said she didn't sing one.
All right. Good morning. Thank you for being here. This meeting is being webcasted and recorded, so all participants, please speak clearly. Members of the public who wish to observe or to address the board may join the meeting at the notice physical location or may use the Zoom application to address the board from a remote location. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available at www.cal-span.org. In addition, we're receiving presentations and public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to present or comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you should already be in the Zoom meeting room using the meeting ID and password you received from the clerk. If you've not already received the meeting ID and the password, you can go to our website at www.waterboards.ca.gov/North Coast. Click on the August 14th to 15th, 2025 board meeting button and follow the instructions to complete a virtual speaker card. You will then receive an email from the clerk with the Zoom login information. For anyone here in the meeting room that wishes to address the board, please complete a speaker card available on the tables outside the boardroom and give it to the clerk. For those in the Zoom meeting, your camera will be turned off and you will be on mute until it is your turn to speak. The clerk will unmute you when it is your turn to address the board. We will call each commenter by name and then unmute each commenter. I would like to ask those who have provided a contact name to please state your name for the record before you speak. There is a normal 5-minute time limit for each commenter. During public testimony, you will see a timer on the screen. For those calling in by phone, we will run the timer and let you know when you have 30 seconds left and when your time is up. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are called upon during public comment. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute. You can remain in the Zoom meeting until the completion of your item and then may choose to exit the meeting. We will continue with the Pledge of Allegiance. If you'd stand and join me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with just liberty and justice for all. Thank you. As a reminder, please put your phones on mute. Okay, roll call. From my left.
Ryan Sundberg, McKinleyville, Northern Humboldt County.
Good morning, everyone. Greg Giusti, Ukiah.
Hector Bedoya, the Healdsburg area.
Jake McKenzie from Roanoke Park.
And remotely?
Alex Hart, Siskiyou County.
Thank you. Valerie, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the board. I'm Valerie Quinto, Executive Officer. To my left is Nathan Jacobson, Counsel to the Board. To my right are Josh Curtis and Claudia Villacorta, Assistant Executive Officers. Across from us is Deirdre Wilkerson, Executive Assistant, and other staff will introduce themselves as their items come up. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we begin, I'd like to just say that when I'm up here representing my area for the region, I put on a filter. It's not a personal one, but I take into consideration the keystone species that need protection in our area, the disadvantaged groups, and consider being the voice to those who do not have a voice, the voiceless, in disadvantaged communities and the endangered species that do not have a voice. They voice by demonstrating dropping populations. So item number six. hearing procedure, opening statements. This is the time and place for a hearing by the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, North Coast Region, to consider adoption of resolution number R1-2025-0030, adopting an amendment to the Water Quality Control Plan for the North Coast Region to establish a total maximum daily load and fecal waste discharge prohibition and incorporate the action plan for pathogens in the Russian River watershed. Will all those who expect to give testimony in this matter please stand, raise your right hand, and take the following oath. Do you swear or affirm that you will tell the truth in this matter? Thank you. The timelines for the presentation are as follows. One, staff will have 45 minutes. Two, the interested public will have 5 minutes each. Three, then we will have board member questions. Board member questions and comments, other than questions clarifying the materials being presented, should be held until after the staff presentation, or until there is a break in the staff presentation, in the presentations for questions. At this time, we will start with the staff presentations. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Bedoya and members of the board. My name is Lisa Bernard. I'm the supervisor of the Planning and TMDL Development Unit here at the North Coast Water Board. I'm here today to present the action plan for pathogens in the Russian River watershed for your consideration as a basin plan amendment. This board adopted an earlier version of this amendment titled the Action Plan for the Russian River Pathogen TMDL in 2019 and again in late 2021. The action plan has not gone into effect since it has not yet been proposed for approval to the State Water Board, Office of Administrative Law, or USCPA. Since 2021, staff have made revisions to the action plan pertaining primarily to implementation for source controls related to on-site waste treatment systems, also known as OTS. The revisions simplify OTS requirements and rely more directly on the statewide OTS policy than previous versions. We presented a draft action plan that included revisions at the April 2025 board meeting during the public comment period for this amendment. Staff have updated the action plan before you today in response to comments received. This is an action item for your consideration to adopt Resolution R1-2025-0030, amending the Water Quality Control Plan for the North Coast Region, or Basin Plan, to establish a total maximum daily load and fecal waste discharge prohibition and incorporate the Action Plan for Pathogens in the Russian River Watershed. If you adopt this resolution today, staff will proceed with the process needed to request approval from the State Water Board for this item. Before we get started, I'd like to orient you to the agenda materials available to you today. These include a staff summary report, presentation slides, maps of the watershed and sampling locations, a pollution versus impairment fact sheet, a response to comments document, the proposed basin plan amendment, adopting resolution R1-2025-0030, and a link to the final staff report, including substitute environmental documentations for compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. This presentation is about 45 minutes long, and I'm going to review the project background and purpose, public engagement, and basic contents of the action plan that we're asking the board to consider. We'll begin with a timeline and process overview, then I'll provide a summary of the staff report. We'll review public engagement conducted for this project. identify a few of the key 2025 comments. I'll offer a summary of the project itself, then a summary of implementation contained in the action plan. Finally, I'll review the key takeaways from today's presentation and make a recommendation to the board to adopt this item for amendment into the basin plan. I welcome your thoughts and comments, as well as your questions, and will periodically pause during the presentation to allow for these before we get all the way through to the end. Water body segments in the Russian River watershed were first listed on the 303D list of impaired waters for bacteria impacting the REC 1 or contact recreation beneficial use in 2001. These listings triggered the project before you today, which relies upon TMDL studies conducted across the watershed between 2008 and 2014. These studies included a recreational beach study, a land cover study, a phylochip microbial community analysis, and an on-site waste treatment systems study. Fecal indicator and microbial source tracking results from these source studies, plus documentation of public health advisory beach alerts, together provided multiple lines of evidence indicating discharges of pathogens in the watershed require control. The land cover study and OT study in particular showed that areas of high-density OTs have elevated E. coli and enterococci of human origin, particularly in the winter period. Conclusions from the four studies were peer-reviewed in 2015 and provided the basis for both the total maximum daily load and a watershed-wide fecal waste discharge prohibition. Staff published draft staff reports and accompanying action plans for public review in 2015 and 2017. Revisions to these earlier drafts led to publication of documents for public review in 2019 that were afterwards adopted by this board. Due to reanalysis of certain data, staff updated the staff report and action plan again in 2021. Posted it for public review and comment, and that action plan was also adopted by this board. Staff initiated the State Water Board approval process in January of 2022. However, staff withdrew from that process in 2023 after concluding that there were benefits to revisiting the OTS program of implementation before moving the requirements of this action plan forward for final approvals and incorporation into the basin plan. We're now here in 2025 on the project timeline. We have revised the OTS program of implementation, published draft documents for public review and comment, revised the staff report and action plan in response to comments received, and we are asking the board to consider adoption of the action plan for pathogens in the Russian River watershed. As you can see from this timeline, the project has been active for nearly two decades. Over that time, the action plan has been developed, updated, and revised several times, resulting in the documents being described today. Staff believe that the documents being proposed today for adoption are the most streamlined yet effective version that we have asked you to consider. The requirements contained in the proposed action plan align with both regional and statewide policies while allowing for flexibility at the local level as appropriate. This graphic presents a general description of the process that any TMDL and basin plan amendment undergoes. Projects are typically initiated during triennial review once identified by this board as a priority project. Where the amendment needs to rely upon science, staff conducts technical studies. Those studies and the conclusions drawn from those studies, including the identification of potential pollutant sources, undergo outside peer review to assess the conclusions which support development of new regulation. This informs development of a program of implementation. The package then undergoes public review and public input, which often leads to revisions. For this action plan, staff have spent considerable time between the steps of source control program development, soliciting and receiving public input, and responding to that input by revising the implementation plan. Once adopted and incorporated into the Basin Plan, new regulations provide a program of implementation to control pollution and meet water quality objectives to protect beneficial uses. The staff report, Basin Plan Amendment, and other project materials constitute substitute environmental documentation in compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act for a basin planning program. The staff report contains several components, including a description of the project setting, a summary of bacteria standards, the problem statement, a chapter on evidence of pollution, a source analysis, a linkage analysis, a TMDL chapter including load and waste load allocations, targets and indicators, a program of implementation, chapters on monitoring and public participation, a CEQA checklist, and a chapter on economic considerations. As you will see from the next slide, the staff report and accompanying documents have been the subject of public review and engagement for a decade. Before I move on, I'll ask if the board has any questions. This project, aimed at protecting the contact recreation, beneficial use, and public health in an area used extensively for recreational purposes, has been considered and revised several times since 2015. The Russian River Pathogen Staff Report and Action Plan have been posted a total of 6 times for public review and comment and adopted twice by this board. Staff have received a variety of comments over the years and endeavored to be responsive to parties' concerns through each revision. While not the only issue raised, a majority of comments have been focused upon OTT's program of implementation, and most recent concerns focused on the retention of the cesspool and holding tank prohibitions from existing basin plan requirements. Current revisions to the staff report and action plan are responsive to these focused concerns while maintaining the overall structure and implementation programs for other source categories. The revised action plan and staff report were made available for public comment and review over the April and May time period this year. Staff made changes to the action plan in response to the most recent comments in order to arrive at the amendment being proposed today. As I mentioned earlier, staff believe this is the most efficient, straightforward version that has come before this board for consideration. Proper notice and meaningful opportunity for comment are important in any public process, including this action plan development process. This project and associated requirements have been undergoing public process, as I said, for over a decade, and over that time there have been 6 public review periods. Each was noticed in a local newspaper for 3 consecutive days, posted on the North Coast Water Board website, and direct notice of availability sent to email subscribers. Staff have held 7 public workshops beyond the 3 legally required CEQA scoping and 2 board hearings. These workshops have also been publicly noticed and posted on our website with direct notice to email subscribers. OTT's implementation staff have been attending biweekly meetings with Sonoma County staff and held quarterly meetings with Mendocino County. Staff have participated in monthly meetings with the Monterio Villa Grande Citizens Advisory Group. In addition, the statewide OTT's policy underwent its own public process during development and adoption, and county regulations, such as those conducted for adoption of OTT's Local Area Management Programs, or LAMPS, undergo public process as well. Mendocino County has already completed this process. Sonoma County is currently undertaking the LAMP process. We anticipate that this board can look forward to considering approval of the Sonoma County LAMP in the near future. Since publication of the 2025 Draft Action Plan, staff has met with the Russian River OTT's owners, Monterio Villa Grande Citizens Advisory Group, and Sonoma County representatives to communicate proposed action plan requirements and the revisions to the action plan based upon comments received. Staff received positive feedback during those discussions related to the changes that we have made. Staff received four comment letters in response to the draft action plan. All public comments have been reconsidered, and staff has provided written responses to each comment in the response to comments document included in your agenda packet. Staff received comments related to public outreach, which I covered in previous slides. Commenters expressed a variety of concerns related to the retention of cesspool and holding tank prohibitions from the existing regional OTS policy. Staff acknowledged these challenges and, upon consideration of other regulatory mechanisms available to manage cesspools and holding tanks, the proposed action plan and final staff report do not retain this prohibition language. Reviewers also expressed concern regarding the cost for upgrades that may be necessary for OTS, such as cesspools and others that do not meet current standards. Staff are sensitive to the fact that change can be difficult and expensive. The action plan before you for consideration today is designed to allow for the greatest flexibility at the local level for OTS installation, replacements, and upgrades, while also aligning with statewide OTS policy requirements. It relies upon approved local area management program requirements, and where allowances for system siting and design requirements can be approved. Staff have limited the Advanced Protection Management Program Area, or APMP, to the minimum requirements identified in the statewide OTS policy, where special provisions aren't identified in an approved LAMP. In addition, staff are committed to continuing efforts working with local entities such as the counties and citizens advisory groups to identify potential funding and wastewater management solutions. Thus far, we have worked to fund and develop a feasibility study in consultation with a citizens advisory group that evaluates potential community-wide wastewater solutions in the Lower Russian River. This effort aims to identify alternatives that could qualify for significant public funding and provide more equitable, cost-effective options for residents. This study was designed to serve as a pilot that could be emulated in communities throughout the Russian River watershed, where they would like to explore alternative solutions to wastewater collection, treatment, and disposal. Last year, staff worked with County of Sonoma to secure 319H funding for a planning grant supporting the county to conduct an assessment of sanitation needs countywide. Similarly, staff continue to support community projects like the upgrades at the Russian River County Sanitation District's Guerneville Wastewater Treatment Plant. That was a mouthful. Upgrade to this treatment plant would potentially allow for additional hookups from properties currently served by OTS. That project has now been included on the fundable list in the draft 2025-26 Clean Water State Revolving Fund intended use plan and is eligible for up to $47.1 million in 100% grant funding for construction, along with an additional $25 million in 50% grant, 50% low-interest loan funding. These funding levels help reduce the cost burden on individual ratepayers and demonstrate our commitment to pursuing solutions that balance environmental protection with fairness to the community. Okay, this slide will show the basic structure of the action plan for pathogens in the Russian River watershed, which I'm going to review piece by piece. You will see on this diagram multiple times as I walk through the remainder of the presentation. This first box contains the fundamental premises at the heart of this action plan, which are that fecal waste pollution is a risk to human health and fecal waste from human and domestic animal sources can and should be controlled. This arrow represents the scientific studies that I referenced earlier when describing the project process diagram, and that I'll speak to further later on in this presentation. It is the assessment of the data from these studies that provides us with evidence of pollution. I'll be walking through the differences between pollution and impairment during a later slide. We then use the evidence of pollution information to identify source categories where the discharge of fecal waste can and should be controlled. Evidence of pollution also supports the TMDL, including application of waste load allocations and load allocations, and it is used to support the fecal waste discharge prohibition. Ultimately, source categories inform control measures leading to implementation actions and associated compliance dates. It is then those implementation actions that provide a compliance pathway for both the TMDL and the fecal waste discharge prohibition. Next, I'm going to walk through the science underlying evidence of pollution and data used to identify sources and potential sources of fecal waste pollution across the watershed. I'll discuss how that same evidence identifies potential sources of fecal pollution requiring control and supports the TMDL fecal waste discharge prohibition and leads to implementation required. Are there any questions before I move forward? I can. I thought I had that booming voice that was going to carry. This is an image of our project area, the Russian River watershed. You have a full-size copy of this image in your agenda packet. The Russian River watershed encompasses approximately 1,500 square miles in Sonoma and Mendocino counties. The main stem is 101 miles long, beginning north of Ukiah and ending in Jenner as it empties to the Pacific Ocean. The Russian River watershed houses the largest population center in the North Coast region. Major municipalities within the watershed include Santa Rosa, Roanoke Park, Windsor, Healdsburg, Sebastopol, Cloverdale, and Ukiah. The watershed also includes numerous unincorporated communities such as Forestville, Guerneville, Monterio, Hopland, and Calpella. The city of Santa Rosa is the most populous of the watershed cities. The Russian River watershed is fairly rural and hosts considerable agriculture. Our economy is based in wine grape cultivation, mixed agriculture, and recreational tourism. It provides a vibrant tourist trade with wine tasting, restaurants, and outdoor activities, especially during the summer months. Recreational opportunities within the Russian River watershed include, but are not limited to, swimming, wading, kayaking, and boating. This action plan was designed to protect and restore waters in the Russian River watershed for the water contact recreation beneficial use. The water contact recreation beneficial use, also known as REC 1, relates to pathogen exposure through activities such as swimming, wading, water skiing, fishing, etc. The action plan applies the statewide bacteria objectives as concentrations of either E. coli or enterococci, depending on salinity, for the protection of the REC 1 beneficial use, applicable to the TMDL waste load allocations and as in-stream targets associated with the TMDL. In this section of the presentation, I will summarize evidence of pollution as indicated in the green on this slide. Each highlighted topic in future slides will be identified similarly. As I showed in the previous timeline slide, staff conducted TMDL studies across the watershed between 2008 and 2014. A recreational beach study, land cover study, phylochip microbial community analysis, and a knot study. These four studies form the scientific basis of the TMDL. These studies all had approved quality assurance plans, approved monitoring scope, and design plans, and collectively underwent peer review. The TMDL studies relied upon the best available thinking and included innovative methods of the times. The four peer-reviewed studies that form the basis of this action plan have not changed. Methods for fecal waste evaluation have advanced since these studies were conducted, and that will be relevant to future monitoring in the watershed. Fecal indicator and microbial source tracking results from these source studies, plus documentation of public health advisory beach alerts together, provided multiple lines of evidence indicating discharges of fecal waste in the watershed require control. The land cover and OTS studies in particular showed that areas of high-density OTS have elevated E. coli and enterococci of human origin in the winter period. Particularly, studies also showed elevated E. coli and other fecal indicators associated with urban developed and rural developed land uses, and provided evidence of human and grazer fecal waste discharge through the use of phylochip DNA tracing. The studies undertaken for this project were designed specifically to identify potential sources of waste discharge, not to determine impairment status. Results from these four studies identified pathogen pollution related to land uses occurring throughout the Russian River watershed. And from that conclusion, we developed both a TMDL and the watershed-wide fecal waste discharge prohibition, which focus on the protection of human health for year-round recreational use within the Russian River and its tributaries. As I mentioned before, the studies undertaken for this project were designed specifically to identify potential sources of waste discharge, not to determine impairment status. As described in the fact sheet included in your agenda packet, California applies a structured assessment process to decide if a water body is impaired. This process uses specific methods outlined in California's listing policy. Water Board staff analyze data from readily available sources, such as the California Environmental Data Exchange Network, or CEDIN, follow strict analytical guidelines and basic data adequacy standards to make sure that impairment findings are appropriate for 303D listing. Placement on the 303D list triggers requirements under the Clean Water Act to develop a total maximum daily load, using scientific studies to determine how much of a pollutant the water body can take without harming beneficial uses. This process is what triggered the Russian River Pathogen Project. The four studies described in the last slide affirm pollution in the watershed. Pollution happens when waste unreasonably affects, harms, or interferes with how we can use water for things like swimming, drinking, fishing, and other beneficial uses. This is different than impairment. A determination of impairment is made when the levels of a pollutant in a water body surpass established regulatory limits, indicating that that water quality does not support certain uses. Impairment is a term from the Federal Clean Water Act, while pollution is associated with the California Water Code. Pollution can be detected by evaluating and analyzing different environmental indicators, like comparing water samples to the water quality objectives in the basin plan, but does not need to meet all aspects of the listing policy. Pollution can also be identified by comparing water quality data to that of a clean reference site, making visual observations, or using scientifically recognized pollutant indicators such as phylochip or Bacteroides bacteria. The approach to assessing pollution can differ based on site-specific conditions, the best available science, and professional expertise. Pollution is a problem, and it needs to be addressed, but it does not necessarily mean that the contact recreation beneficial uses are not supported in a given location. While the action plan does address water body segments identified on the 303D list, it is based upon evidence of pollution and requirements to control sources and potential sources of fecal waste to meet and maintain protection of beneficial uses and public health. This slide shows the locations across the watershed where samples were collected for the four studies I spoke to earlier. A full-size copy of this image is contained in your agenda packet. It depicts the sample locations distributed throughout the Russian River watershed. As you can see on the right side slide, much of the data collected concentrated on the lower Russian River, where human population is also more concentrated. The data collected from the monitoring stations has been assessed on a station-by-station basis to determine in-stream evidence of pollution. Staff analyzed laboratory results for E. coli and Enterococcus fecal indicator bacteria, or FIB, Bacteroides bacteria for humans and bovine species, and phylochip DNA profiling for human, grazer, and bird species. The analysis of in-stream data from both main stem and tributary locations across the watershed show evidence of fecal waste pollution. In addition, staff looked at other lines of evidence, including public health advisories and evidence from the land cover study, in support of the pathogen findings and resulting action plan for the control of pathogens in the Russian River watershed. Now that I've reviewed the scientific studies and evidence of pollution, as indicated by the green, we'll review the sources and potential sources of pollution identified through those four studies. Chief among the TMDL studies was the 2013 assessment of fecal indicator bacteria concentrations measured from areas with different land covers, the land cover study. The objective of the land cover study was to assess the relative magnitude and variability of fecal indicator bacteria concentrations in waters draining from each of the major land uses present across the Russian River watershed during both dry and wet weather periods. All land cover study samples were analyzed for Enterococcus, E. coli, and total coliform bacteria, as well as human and bovine-specific Bacteroides bacteria concentrations. Results from the land cover study confirmed that all land cover types are associated with detection of Bacteroides bacteria with concentrations above and with concentrations above the REC 1 criteria. The land cover study also found human-sourced Bacteroides were higher in on-site septic areas compared to urban sewered areas, and that bacteria concentrations in wet periods were higher than dry periods, indicating that fecal waste discharge is strongly influenced by stormwater and runoff patterns. Source identification also included an assessment of uses across the watershed that may be associated with potential fecal waste discharges to surface water. This list represents potential sources associated with human fecal waste. And these are the potential fecal sources identified associated with domestic and animal waste. So some key takeaways for source identification. Wait a minute, I need to go back. Oh, I'm missing a slide. That's okay, I'll just tell you what the key takeaways are. The key takeaways for source control include that human and domestic animal fecal waste are found throughout the watershed across all land cover types. Human source Bacteroides were higher in on-site septic areas compared to urban sewered areas, and higher levels were detected in wet weather associated with runoff patterns. In these next set of slides, I'll provide an overview of the total maximum daily load aspect of this project. A total maximum daily load is a calculation of the maximum amount of a pollutant that a water body can receive and still meet water quality objectives. The TMDL equals the loading capacity of the water body for the pollutant plus a margin of safety to account for any uncertainties and includes natural background concentrations. The loading capacity and by extension the TMDL in this action plan is based upon statewide standards for the protection of Rec 1. The loading capacity of the Russian River watershed for pathogens is given as a concentration of the fecal indicator bacteria E. coli in freshwaters and enterococci in saline waters, as per the statewide objectives adopted by the State Water Board in 2018. For the purpose of this TMDL, natural background concentrations are not expressly represented by a separate term, but included in the allocations. Anthropogenic or human-caused pollutant sources are characterized as either point sources that receive a waste load allocation or as non-point sources that are assigned load allocations. The action plan for pathogens in the Russian River watershed incorporates waste load allocations based upon the statewide limits for fecal indicators associated with potential sources of pathogenic waste that are permitted to discharge to surface waters. Load allocations within the action plan are zero for most non-point sources and set load allocations for agricultural categories equal to the Rec 1 objective. In addition to support for the TMDL, the evidence of pollution also supports a fecal waste discharge prohibition. Under the Water Code, the Board is able to establish discharge prohibitions in the Basin Plan. The fecal waste discharge prohibition on this slide is contained in the Action Plan and applies to the Russian River watershed. It is established to meet Rec 1 water quality objectives and to protect human health from controllable fecal waste discharges. It reads, discharges of waste containing fecal material from humans or domestic animals to waters of the state within the Russian River watershed are prohibited. The action plan identifies entities across the watershed, both public and private, responsible for implementing source controls that meet the fecal waste discharge prohibition and allocations associated with the TMDL. It is important when establishing a TMDL or a prohibition that those requirements be accompanied by a pathway to compliance for responsible entities. The action plan provides a list of entities, control measures, and timelines for that compliance. The action plan identifies these 24 public entities responsible for controlling the controllable sources of fecal pollution within their influence. Private entities with influence over controllable fecal waste sources are also required under the action plan to meet the fecal waste discharge prohibition and TMDL allocations. Every anthropogenic source of pathogens in the watershed has a control measure. This is a summary of the control measures for compliance with the TMDL and fecal waste discharge prohibition. Each of these applies to specific source categories, control measures, and compliance timelines, which can be found in detail in tables 6.3.7-3 and 6.3.7-7 of the action plan, which is one of the items in your agenda packet. First, all sources and potential sources of fecal waste discharge must implement adequate treatment and or best management practices to prevent the discharge of fecal waste material from humans or domestic animals from entering a water of the state, either directly or indirectly. Sources regulated under an NPDES permit must comply with fecal waste and pathogen-related provisions contained within their permit. Similarly, sources regulated under a WDR or waiver of WDRs must comply with the fecal waste and pathogen-related provisions contained within their permit. Local agencies are to implement the terms of any memorandum of understanding with the North Coast Water Board to collaboratively address fecal waste from homeless encampments and recreational water use. Non-dairy livestock are to implement best management practices to achieve the assigned load allocation and, if required by the executive officer, develop and implement a ranch management plan, or comply with all fecal waste and pathogen-related provisions of an applicable non-dairy livestock WDR or waiver of WDRs. Existing, new, and replacement pots are to report cesspools, holding tanks, and seepage pits to water board staff, comply with an approved LAMP, and comply with applicable waste discharge requirements or waivers of waste discharge requirements, such as the statewide OTS policy waiver. Our implementation for OTS source control, as I said before, relies heavily on the statewide OTS policy. Mm-hmm. So, statewide OTS policy components. The owners shall maintain proper function and assure adequate treatment and disposal. The action plan defers to approved local area management programs. It also defers to attachment 2 of the statewide OTS policy or special provisions of an approved LAMP to define the geographic scope and special requirements applicable within an APMP. Regional components include compliance with the fecal waste discharge prohibition and a watershed-wide OTS assessment to be conducted by North Coast Water Board staff. It requires that owners report the presence of the cesspools and holding tanks, as I said before. The OTS action plan also provides a checklist for a basic operational inspection that may be conducted by OTS owners and notes that a professional OTS inspection may be required on a case-by-case basis if requested. The action plan anticipates compliance with regulatory permits and orders to be implemented for pathogen source control. Monitoring and reporting. Regulated entities will follow the best management practices for and monitoring data collection and reporting requirements of their permits and orders. In addition, monitoring conducted through the Russian River Regional Monitoring Program will help to inform future adaptive management. Monitoring data will be submitted to publicly accessible databases. Effectiveness of source control measures will be overseen through routine permit compliance tools. Data within the California Environmental Data Exchange Network will be routinely assessed during the integrated report process. Adaptive management should occur throughout these processes to ensure source control mechanisms are effective or improved management practices where needed. So, some key takeaways on source control. Source control focuses on human and domestic animal waste. The action plan points to existing regulatory and non-regulatory mechanisms, such as permits, the OTS policies, and memorandums of understanding. Monitoring and reporting relies upon existing regulatory and non-regulatory mechanisms. Regulated entities will be required to follow the monitoring, reporting, and best management practices of their permits and orders that are used for source control. The action plan relies upon adaptive management to measure success of the control mechanisms implemented and to manage source control activities over time. Landing the plane. So here are some overall action plan takeaways. The goal of the action plan is to protect the Rec 1 beneficial use. Data assessment shows evidence of pollution across the watershed. To that end, the TMDL is based on the statewide bacteria objective for Rec 1. In addition, the action plan establishes a prohibition against the discharge of human and domestic animal waste. All source categories have been assigned a waste load allocation or load allocation and are subject to compliance with the fecal waste discharge prohibition. The action plan provides pathways to compliance for every potential source. Staff recommend that the board adopt today resolution R1-2025-0030, approving and adopting the CEQA substitute environmental documentation for this project, amending the basin plan, and allowing staff to forward the basin plan amendment package to the State Water Board, initiating the process for approval consideration. I've included here a list of our current contacts for team members. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
The order right now is interested public.
Would it be possible to ask a question before we get to public comment, or do you wish to wait until after?
It's part of the sequence. So after public comments, we'll hear from the board.
Okay.
I thought I had a booming voice. Okay, so let's hear from public comments. Anyone online?
I don't have anyone online, but there are a couple of people here in person who would like to comment.
Okay, please.
Todd?
Morning, Chair, members of the board. Thank you, Lisa, for the presentation. I'm Todd Hunsdorfer. I'm the water quality analyst with Sonoma County and the county water quality ombudsman that was referenced in one of Lisa's slides for the outreach that she did in an effort to accomplish these revisions. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to make a few comments. First of all, I wanted to thank the staff that have worked really hard to get the action plan to this point. It certainly wasn't easy, but the County of Sonoma is pleased with the response to comments and hopes that it's representative of a desire for us to work collaboratively with the regional board on finding and fixing sources of fecal pathogens in the watershed. Along those same lines, the County of Sonoma is very interested in being part of developing and participating in the parcel assessment program that was referenced in some of the slides and proposed in the action plan. So, for example, we hope to work with staff at the regional board to help design how we share information, participate in public forums in partnership with the regional board, and coordinate on outreach to the community. Related to outreach, while significant, the county feels strongly that a better effort could have been made in the future to communicate with the public more effectively. So, for example, if the regional board is looking to collect data with the parcel assessment program for this action plan at the parcel level, then the board should consider a mechanism to contact individual property owners in the watershed. We're looking for that level of granularity. In addition, there are a number of other community groups and boards that could help amplify the messaging, and it would be great in the future to see the regional board connect with them. The county is happy to help support that type of effort. Lastly, the County of Sonoma would like to use this opportunity to advocate for long-range monitoring and data collection program in the watershed. R3MP was referenced in Lisa's slides. It's assumed, I think, that the actions detailed in the plan will be effective at reducing pathogens, but there's currently no way of capturing this type of feedback to inform programmatic solutions or revisions to these proposed programs. And we know these are tough financial times, budgets are tight, but data is an essential part of making cost-effective, water quality-centric decisions in the watershed. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for your comment, and by all means, our water board will collaborate with the county, and there's always room for improvement in communication. So looking forward to seeing efforts on both sides. Anyone else?
Sure. Brenda?
Good morning, Brenda Edelman, Russian River Watershed Protection Committee. I may need to go a little over 5 minutes as
okay.
I can't talk as fast as I used to. At any rate, we believe, Russian River Watershed Protection Committee believes this staff report for the action plan for pathogens in Russian River Watershed is an excellent work. We've been tracking this for over 20 years. We've submitted comments many times in the past, and we have some words to illustrate how we feel about this document. We feel it's inclusive, logical, thorough, comprehensive, intelligent, and most importantly, honest. We want to thank the staff who have worked on this very impressive accomplishment. We still have some questions and comments and concerns. One question that nobody's touched on, and maybe it's irrelevant, is we wonder if fecal bacteria attached to sediments back in the days of Santa Rosa's discharges can break loose somehow and be capable of infecting river visitors. I wonder if it's bioavailable. We feel there's not enough focus on impacts caused by recreation users and the homeless. Efforts to persuade the county to take more action in these areas needs greater force. For instance, what has been discussed about situating porta potties for boaters along the river? What ideas have been put forth with homeless people living along the river in summertime? And failures of central sewer systems during high floods over 42 feet, especially Russian River County Sanitation District. This has been a serious problem at least since 2014 and has not yet been solved for the most part. There's not enough headway in dealing with this issue, and I really realize that funds are the issue and that you're attempting to get state funds, and they may or may not become available, but we don't really care for some of the options coming forward about sending long pipelines from Guerneville to Santa Rosa or Windsor. We feel that's going to be very problematic, but we won't spend time on it now. We'll be commenting on that in the future. We wonder what conclusions were drawn about monitoring of lower river beaches in summer taking place with the biological opinion that indicate relatively few exceedances of E. coli and other pathogens in the data. And that's 16 years worth of data on the summer beaches for the entire summer. It's weekly data points. While this document attempts to explain the great amount of data available to substantiate the health hazard claim, we wonder what it means when there's very small presence of pathogens in a situation where it is implied there's a serious problem. And that is, except for a study that was done on July 5th, one of the years, July 4th holidays, the busiest time, especially at Montereo Beach. And there's bound to be, it's just a given that there's going to be a lot of bacteria present the day afterwards. But most of the time, there are few, if any, exceedances of E. coli on that beach. And it's never been fully explained to us why that is, if it's Montereo is considered a big problem. The regrowth of bacteria in storage ponds that gets discharged into waterways has been a big concern going back many years, and we're very glad this document mentions the problem and will attempt to address it. And there are five areas listed in the wastewater systems that need to have special requirements in order to meet guidelines. And we note that Russian River County Sanitation District is the only discharger to appear on all five lists. And this system has been a problem since the beginning. And I know that's taken a lot of your staff time. But at some point, things have to be solved. And it's mostly a money issue. And this is a nationwide problem where small systems sometimes just run into money problems, or most of the time, because things have gotten so expensive and the requirements keep increasing. So I don't know what the answer is, but and I hear you may qualify for a $47 million loan, which is enough to fix Guerneville's collection system, but when there's other systems that also need money, will you be able to get that from the state? I don't know. We're not addressing OTS issues here right now because there are others who understand the issue at a much greater level than we do. But we feel, nevertheless, there's a lot of low and middle income housing in the Lower River. And the new septic system regulations are likely to be too expensive for many of the property owners and indirectly the renters, too. There are also many elderly in the Russian River. A lot of elderly people have owned second houses in the past or inherited second houses and find it a wonderful place to spend their later years. And I'm one of them. And it's just a wonderful place to be. I love it much more than being in a big city. I grew up in Chicago, so I know big city life quite well. At the same time, most government loans do not go to individuals for septic upgrades, and that's a big problem. And the state is really pushing this board to focus on bringing together a whole bunch of small areas into larger systems, which is going to be very growth-inducing and have urbanizing impacts, and is going to do away with the kind of quality of life that we have there now. And it may be, you know, it's like the septic systems provide you with a lot of small problems, and the big systems just have big problems. So which is worse? Take your choice. There is no one single solution that's going to solve all the problems with the hazards. And I'm someone who cares a lot about having a clean river, but at some point it's just impossible to do it perfectly. Many people living in the area do it for the trees, the quiet, and the beauty. It may also be one of the most healthy areas in the county. We have very clean air. What is being now proposed for our health, however, may not provide the desired outcome. It's a real conundrum. And I know that your staff have worked very hard to bring about change to make the river cleaner. And I don't want to sound like I don't support that. I'm just pointing out some of the problems. And just one other thing, there's very little said in it about the biological opinion and the lowering of flows and also concern about conditions during floods and drought. These are the extreme situations that are never fully dealt with and are create the most pollution problems. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Brenda, thank you so much for voicing your concerns, and I'd like to ask staff to address your questions, your technical questions, at some
point.
Thank you. And Lisa, thank you so much for your presentation, you and your team.
I just wanted to note that board member Hart has her hand raised, and I wasn't sure if that was a question for Brenda or board member Hart, if you want to let us know.
Yeah. Hi, I Chair Bedoya kind of hit on it. I was hoping that staff could address some of Brenda's comments. I don't know if it was appropriate now, if we had more commenters or if we needed to wait, but because I also had my own questions prior to Brenda coming up, but she mirrored a couple of the questions I had, specifically the focus, the lack of focus on, or maybe there was focus and it just wasn't hit upon, but can you maybe talk a little bit more about the recreational uses and homelessness and the impacts if that was studied? And along with, there seemed to be a couple comments from other submitted written comments regarding the lower river beaches and how staff identified that it's the, forgive me, I'm terrible with acronyms, the OTS or something. OTS, thank you. OTS, how is it that OTS are, I think Monte Rio Beach seemed to be one in particular. How is it that staff came to the conclusion that bacterial inputs from OTS were the primary source versus others? I mean, what scientific methods did you all use to identify that? I mean, can you just go into depth about that, please?
Sure. So I'll start off by saying that staff is not necessarily calling out any one potential source as the exact problem at a particular location. What the studies that we conducted did was that we looked at kind of the bottom of catchments where land uses were more than 50% of that land use. So maybe more than 50% agriculture, more than 50% sewered urban areas, more than 50% on-site waste treatment systems. We did do a special on-site waste treatment system study. I'll speak to that separately. But essentially, that land cover study is what we call it, showed that we still have fecal waste in our waterways discharging. And so what we did was we looked across the landscape and we said, okay, well, what activities are occurring that are associated with human or domestic fecal waste? And then we came up with a program of control for each of those. It's a lot more difficult when we're talking about the unhoused population. And, you know, there have been some ideas floated here by Brenda, and I'm sure others have thought of too, for recreational users. But for static activities, each one has their own control mechanism. And if they are adequately, that they being the source category, are adequately controlling fecal waste, nothing more needs to be done. We're not pointing at any specific thing. We're saying, do your part, each potential source. And so then when we talk about beaches and recreation, you know, we're We're grateful that county has been doing beach bacterial studying for over 20 years. Every summer they go out to the most popular beaches and they test. And, you know, they have posted on their website whether or not, you know, elevated concentrations have been detected in over the 1 week period that they're testing the frequency of all summer long. Again, with the homeless, you know, and the recreational beach users, we have right now a memorandum of understanding together with the County of Sonoma that, you know, we're going to do everything that we can within our power to control discharges from those sources and work together with the county to potentially identify solutions. But, you know, especially the unhoused population, it's a social problem that a lot of people are struggling to tackle. And we're not saying that it isn't a problem. We're saying it is a problem. You know, we do have the fecal waste discharge prohibition that applies to every single potential source. So that applies to the unhoused population. That applies to the recreational beach users as well. But implementing that and enforcing on that sometimes falls outside the purview of the Regional Water Board. Did I answer your question?
So there were a few questions that Brenda had, and they were relatively technical. One was, can bacteria within the sediment reactivate?
No, it cannot. Bacteria has a very short half-life. It doesn't repopulate. The fecal bacterium don't repopulate outside of the intestinal tract. So once it's released, it has its potential impact, but then it dies off in the system. So contrary to sediment that we were talking about yesterday, when the source for fecal waste is turned off, the water cleans up pretty fast.
Did you get that, Brenda?
Let me pause for a second. Maybe Brenda could sit up there to hear the answers for a moment.
No, it's been fixed.
Is it been fixed? Okay, sorry.
You can still sit with me.
Do you want to summarize?
I'm sorry. I was having a problem with the hearing device.
Sure.
Yeah.
But we were reviewing some of the questions that you had just to make sure that you were satisfied with the answers.
Okay, the main question, and I'll have to get my paper for the others, was, thank you. This, whether or not, you know, we had years and years and years of discharges from Santa Rosa into the river, and I had learned during that time that the bacteria can reside in the sediments and get re-released at a later time. And I'm just wondering if anyone has ever looked into the possibility of whether there are bacteria that go back a long time that during a flood, say, or other circumstances can be released back into the river. I haven't heard anyone ever speak to that, and I just wondered if it was a possibility.
Can I answer them one at a time? Would that be okay, Brenda? Can I answer you one at a time?
Oh, sure.
Okay, great. So this was my understanding, and I double-checked with my bacteria experts in the back, Prachi and Lance, who are my technical support folks. And they say that bacteria cannot live in the sediment and then remobilize. It does have a very short lifespan, and so that will not happen. In a flood, of course, I'll address that piece separately. In a flood, as I said in the presentation, we found that during rainfall, you know, that stormwater and stormwater runoff patterns can influence and escalate bacteria concentrations. So in the flood, that would be also very true, and we would have a temporary circumstance during that flooded condition. But bacteria doesn't live very long.
What is remobilized are nutrients.
Yeah.
For example, phosphorus.
Right.
Okay, let's see. Indicating. Yeah, one question. I mean, the whole document addresses the presence of bacteria, but one question I had is, what does it mean scientifically if there's lack of bacteria in an area where you would expect there to be bacteria, such as Montereo Beach in the summertime? The studies, the biological opinion has data, the water agency does data on the lower river beaches weekly for three or four months, I think. And there's almost no exceedances of E. coli, next to none, for the whole period over the 16-year period and from one beach to the other. So I was just wondering if you might have an explanation for why that would be.
So bacteria, as I said, is short-lived, and we're also talking about a water body that's moving. So depending on when those samples are taken in relationship to when the recreational activity is occurring, that could have an influence on what the results are. According to our 2026 assessment of bacteria in the Russian River, it has been recommended that we do not delist Montereo Beach in particular, based on the data that has been collected and assessed through our process. So, but nobody's saying that it's one particular source, right? I'm not saying aughts are impacting Montereo Beach. It's very likely to be recreational users. Our recreational study did indeed find that recreational use increases the bacteria concentrations in the water where it occurs, and that above levels that we would like to see for Rec 1.
I guess it struck me as an irony that this whole project is to protect the public from bacteria, and yet they are the ones helping to contribute to the problem.
I think Rec 1 is one of the only beneficial uses I can think of that impairs itself.
Lisa, can I ask a clarifying question? So just to follow up on this line of thinking, Montereo Beach, Johnson's Beach, Forestville Access Beach, Steelhead Beach, Healdsburg Veterans Memorial Beach, and Camp Rose Beach. These have collectively they've been sampled over 200 times. Collectively, there's probably 10 exceedances out of 200. I mean, these are very populated areas. How many of these places have facilities to accommodate people's needs?
I don't know the answer to
that. But I would, Memorial Beach, Steelhead Beach, Johnson's Beach, they have to have sanitation facilities. I'm getting nods in the back. So again, there are lots of things that can affect, as you said, bacteria doesn't linger, but places that have facilities,
right,
people use them. Another question you raised in talking about recreational users, you know, I live north. It's been hot. It's been triple digits for the last week. When I drive between Ukiah and Cloverdale, there's always people pulled off the side of the road, dipping their toes in the river. This weekend, there will be hundreds of people between Ukiah and Cloverdale. Mm-hmm. There's not a blue room in sight.
Right.
Nowhere. There's no facilities to help people meet their needs. And I appreciate the County of Sonoma stepping up, but it's Caltrans that's providing those turnoff spots on Highway 101. So they need to be brought into the discussion as well, because I don't think it's fair to put the burden of costs on Mendocino County or Sonoma County when they don't control those access points. All of those access points are provided by the state through Caltrans. And so, again, I really appreciate this discussion, and I really appreciate the foundation that this document gives in terms of making a very strong program. But
in addition, if those facilities are not maintained, they won't be used.
Right.
Right. There's a cost.
If they
there's
are
an
not
absolute
stocked,
cost.
They will not be used.
But the fact is, they're not there. You know, so there's no cost involved because nobody's taking care of it. But my point is, I don't think it falls to the county solely to pick up. It's Caltrans. It's the state highway that is providing access to these turnoffs. Mm-hmm. So,
Brenda, I hope that helped your understanding. If you have questions, I'm sure the public
I just have one other point I'd like to mention. Russian River County Sanitation District probably has the most problems of just about any other system in the county. And yet the county has very little, I mean, we have the Monterio group that's focused mostly on septics, but the Russian River County Sanitation District really works alone and doesn't welcome any input from the public. There are just very few meetings between that entity and public, and I know I'm given very few opportunities to make suggestions or get information. A lot of times I feel like staff was told not to talk to me, in fact. So I just would love to see this board make suggestions to the county about having more public involvement and reveal more information about what's going on with the system, because there are repairs and changes that were supposed to have been made for the last 11 years when they had a major pipeline break. And there's been nothing but exceedances and problems. I estimate, based on charts in your document, that there's been 2.5 million gallons of raw or improperly treated sewage during floods into the Russian River. It goes far beyond anything any other entity in the county or maybe even in the state has. This is a big problem, and I know it's an expensive problem. I know money's an issue now, but the public would like to know more about what the county's doing to deal with this issue, and I would hope your agency would put more pressure on them to make that happen. Thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you, Brenda.
Since
we have the ombudsman here, is there a response to that? What's the county doing about those discharges?
Yeah, I'm happy to make a brief comment. Although I'll admit, I don't work for Sonoma Water. I'm with the county administrator's office. Brenda and I are good friends, and I'm hopeful to have continued conversations with her moving forward. I think the points she was making today are ones that are well known by the county, and there's been a significant amount of work in the West County with Sonoma Water to engage with the public around regionalization and recycled water feasibilities options. So. I would just say that we're on a great path, I think, and I look forward to continuing to engage with Brenda in that way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Board members, let's have a discussion. Yes, Jake.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I must say that I've been learning quite a bit. I thought I understood water policy matters in the county of Sonoma, having worked in this area for about 30 years. Until recently, I wasn't aware that you existed, Mr. Ombudsman, and you answered one of my questions. You report to the CAO, I would gather. But the thing that interested me was, in reading the documents here, there have been presentations to the county supervisors. I think everybody is aware that the county supervisors exist as themselves. They also exist as the directors of Sonoma Water, formerly Sonoma County Water Agency. And there seems to be a memorandum of understanding. I never heard of any memorandum of understanding dealing with water policy issues. I chaired the Water Advisory Committee with Sonoma County Water. I was involved in various aspects of water policy. But it's an old MOU. Can I assume that as a result of, if we do in fact move forward and approve this action plan, that there will be a review of the MOU? Because the implementation of this action plan, as I read it, mainly depends on local government, on Santa Rosa operation of the sub-regional plant on what Sonoma Water is doing. So we're overseeing the action plan once it is revised and approved. But it would seem our oversight is over all of the activities of these agencies. Am I correct in saying that, Madam Executive Officer?
In a broad sense, I believe yes. Our relationship with these local entities depends on the type of activity that they're carrying out. So, for example, you mentioned the Laguna Subregional Plant or the Russian River CSD. We have a specific relationship with those facilities in terms of issuing them NPDES permits for their discharges to surface water. So that's one kind of relationship we have with local government. When it comes to issues like recreation and homelessness, those are issues we also have a relationship with local government, but we don't have as clear and direct a regulatory pathway to work with local governments on those issues. And that's the purpose of that memorandum of understanding, is to, in the absence of a clear mechanism such as an NPDES permit, that MOU is designed to delineate how we will work together to address those issues. So you're correct, that is an old MOU. That's a function of the drawn-out nature of this TMDL process. We've been talking for at least a year about updating that MOU with the county, and both internally among regional board staff, and also I understand that our staff have had conversations with county staff, including our ombudsman, and decided to hold off on updating until this TMDL process was complete. But that's very much in our short view of next steps, once we're hopefully through with with this adoption, to move forward and work with the county to update that MOU. Does that answer your question?
It does in a way. It would seem to me, Mr. Chair, that the MOU dealing with the Sonoma County, I don't know what exists with Mendocino County, that is something that this board at least should receive a briefing and have a discussion. Now, maybe you as executive officer feel that that's within your purview. I happen to think, as an individual board member, that it's extremely important that this board be aware of this key mechanism to implement what will be the revised action plan.
Mm-hmm. My
views on funding were publicized by myself yesterday. They continue today. The funding problems for monitoring programs. If we're putting an action plan in place and the counties are supposed to, agencies are implementing it, we need to have a viable monitoring program that is ongoing, that enables us to see what impact these measures have had on the level of bacterial contamination in our watersheds. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And when you do develop a draft MOU, maybe you can share it with us so we can review it.
Certainly. It's been this agency's practice consistently to have documents such as that executed at a staff level, but I think it's totally appropriate and helpful to share it with board members in an informal way and see if individual board members have any feedback.
Thank you. Alex, do you have your hand up?
Yes, thank you, Chair. So, Lisa, I have a couple different comments or questions, rather. Let me just... can we start with... I mean, this is just kind of for my own understanding, and if this is too technical of a question, then I understand, but how many, has it been quantified how many cesspools are actually in the watershed versus septic systems?
It has not. That is the purpose of the assessment that we have literally assigned ourselves in the action plan that will be conducted on a phased approach over the next 10 years.
Okay, I understand. I that was it. In all the documents, it wasn't quite clear to me. Can you pull up your slide 17? Great.
Yes.
Great. Okay. So I'm going to be dating myself here, I'm afraid. But I mean, I was high school when these studies were going on. Can you just tell me a little bit more about like who conducted these studies and who did the peer review? Can you just give me a little more information about that?
Sure. So I'll start with these studies were conducted by our staff. So they were designed by our staff. They were executed by our staff. The peer review is something that is a requirement of the Health and Safety Code, right? So we have an external peer review process that occurs for all new regulation across the state. And so we work with a representative over at State Board. We have who has a contract with the UC system, and so we give them our conclusions. Our basically our first draft of the staff report is what they get, with some very specific questions, things like, is this scientifically valid? Are the conclusions here scientifically supportable? Those type of questions. In specific, the staff report that went forward for this project, for example, identified a fecal waste discharge prohibition as a potential or likely outcome of the results from the studies. Anyways, we have a blind process where we give our documents to State Board, and then State Board finds the correct experts in the field, and then those experts provide the feedback all of the materials. So they looked at the studies themselves, the design, the monitoring plans, and the conclusions from those studies and the staff report and any other relevant information that we felt was necessary to support the conclusions, and then gave us feedback. And their feedback is then incorporated into the staff report. So if they say you need to also, for example, in this one, one of our peer reviewers recommended that we also include Enterococcus as part of our body of fecal indicator bacteria that we assess for determining whether or not there's pollution. And so we incorporated Enterococcus results, even though in freshwater, our State Board objective for freshwater is E. coli. So that's one example of how we incorporate the peer review process.
Okay, thank you. Next slide, can you jump to slide 34?
I printed everything in black and white, so it's really hard to see the numbers. Okay, here we go, source control.
It stood out to me and I want to drill down a little bit on it. Under your non-dairy livestock bullet point list deal here, you stated that you're going to have, I just want to make sure I have a clear understanding here. The requirement is going to be that folks that don't fall under a non-dairy category, folks that do not fall under the dairy livestock category, they need to develop and implement an executive officer approved ranch management plan. So that's like going to be a requirement, correct?
No, sorry if it appears that way. So
it does. Cause I was going to drill down on that asking, do you understand how costly that is? And we were talking about costs of small property owners and rural home site owners. I mean, this would be a huge factor here. So can you please expound upon what you meant by this?
Absolutely. So let me clarify that the initial requirement, the baseline expectation is that every property owner with non-dairy livestock would implement best management practices on their own property in compliance with the fecal waste discharge prohibition to prevent the discharge of fecal waste from their property. If for some reason a particular property came to the attention of staff, at that time it is possible that the executive officer might require a ranch management plan from that property owner for very specific reasons of, discharge of fecal waste. We would probably try, as we do always, to work with folks, at a staff level and encourage a compliance and give guidance, here's another best management practice that you might want to try before we went to the level of asking for something at the executive officer level. And then the second half of that statement there is also that we don't currently have a WDR or a waiver of WDRs developed for non-dairy livestock. So if that ever comes to bear, then the compliance mechanism would be that order.
Yeah. So thank you for that. That's illuminating. My next question, just again, further understanding, what do you define as non-dairy livestock properties? Could that be I have one goat and that's it? Or could that be I have to have like 10 goats and a dog? I mean, what's the threshold for, is there a difference between someone who just has a single pet compared to, is there a threshold?
There isn't a threshold. Okay. The threshold is the fecal waste discharge prohibition. So, to be blunt, keep your poop on your own property.
Okay. I guess then just my follow-up would be, I don't have the plan open in front of me. I apologize. I just have your presentation up on screen and my notes, and I failed to write it down, but I would just hope that in the plan itself, it's clear what you just described on my first question about implementation of a ranch management plan would only occur under, if you're not meeting the best management practices expectation. I just hope that the language is clear in your plan about that.
I hope so too. I also don't have it directly in front of me.
I'm sorry, and I don't want to waste time going to dig it out. But
I just pulled it up, and it is different. I'm Board Member Hart. I'm sorry we didn't catch this on the slide. It's not clear on the slide. I believe the language is clear in the action plan, speaking to the progression that Lisa talked about. Everybody needs to implement management practices. If the executive officer requires a ranch management plan of a particular property, then it's required, and then further the detail about in the future developing a permit. I also just wanted to add that at the point that, if and when the regional board does adopt develop and bring to the board a permit waiver or WDRs for non-dairy livestock, at that point there would be some kind of threshold to define what properties are covered by this. But because the requirement in the TMDL is, as Lisa said, keep your poop on your own property, it's appropriate for that to apply to everyone. And then, staff aren't going to require a ranch management plan for one goat. It would be cheaper for somebody to just control one goat's poop than it would be for them to develop a ranch management plan. So that's what we want to see, is the control of waste.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I just wanted it to, it wouldn't shock me for members of the public to maybe get confused with that. So thank you for the clarification.
So there are some properties that are limited in size, but they have a high concentration of animals. Let's say a hypothetical horse, an equestrian property, mm-hmm, that has 30 horses. There's an accumulation of manure, and maybe they stockpile it for years, and there's leachates that go into a low area. Those wouldn't be until somebody complains about them, nothing's going to happen.
Probably true.
So it's up to them to manage, either sell the compost, sell it to composters, or spread it on some land.
Right. Okay. And they could compost it themselves, or, you know, find another option.
Sure.
As well. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, when we did the dairy program development, did we do like a fact sheet for best management practices for non-dairy livestock too? Does that sound familiar to anybody but me?
It sounds familiar, but it's been a while, so I'm not sure. Chair Bedoya, I just wanted to note, you know, this provision in there really is for us to deal with the significant complaints we get. We've had issues in the past of a complaint on a property where there's, you know, really egregious fecal waste going into streams, and we don't have a great mechanism to deal with it because we didn't have a prohibition and we don't have a permit. And so it becomes a really tricky thing to deal with. And this, sure, gives us that ability to deal with those large cases, those significant issues. That's what this is there for. And the goal really, and I think the region understands the need long term for some sort of what we've called grazing permit, but really non-dairy livestock permit outside of federal lands. Again, that's resource constraints keep
just
us from that.
Just
at the moment.
As a side note, it'd be great if the county would make it easier for composters to take this material and recycle it. Board members, any further discussion?
Just a comment. I'm sorry, it just keeps flashing my mind, this potential bumper sticker, keep poop on your own property. I'm trying to put that out in a side bin, but it just keeps flashing. Again, I want to compliment staff on just speaking for me, giving me a document that gives me a lot of comfort, has a lot of strength. There's a lot of foundational material here that is used to build on your conclusions and your proposed actions. I look to this document, if we should pass it today, to provide staff with leveraging an entrenched bureaucracy like Caltrans to get on board and help us with recreational access to the Russian River. But to be blunt, the Russian River, being an urbanized river, is polluted. And this document demonstrates that there are pollutants that can be controlled. Others, like phosphorus and things, can be more challenging because they're sediment-driven. But anthropomorphic-driven pollutants can be controlled. Not 100%, but there are so many obvious sources that need to be addressed that I'm looking to this document, and as this document evolves, to address those anthropomorphic sources. So, I just want to compliment staff. Generations of staff, 21 years, right? This isn't all you, Lisa. This thing's been going on for a long time. And I think, this has my full support.
Thank you.
I don't have any questions. Just wanted to compliment staff. I'm coming late to the party here. But I can tell from the document and the speakers that very controversial, possibly controversial document that you guys have worked through and really got the best case scenario for everyone. I'm sure everyone's not happy completely, but that's probably the best thing. So I think you guys did a really good job.
Thank you. I just want to note that Dr. Lance Lay and Dr. Kelsey Cody and Dr. Prachi Kulkarni and Charles Reed too have all been amazing partners throughout the development process. Great team members.
And the document quality speaks to that. So, board, I think we're ready to consider this. I would entertain a motion to adopt resolution number R1-2025-0030, amending the water quality control plan for the North Coast region to include the action plan for pathogens in the Russian River watershed, including the prohibition against the discharge of fecal waste materials in the Russian River watershed, and to remove the policy on the control of water quality with respect to the on-site waste treatment and disposal practices specific to the Russian River watershed, including the Laguna de Santa Rosa, and authorize the executive officer or designee to submit the amendments adopted under the North Coast Water Board Resolution Number R1-2025-0030, including any non-substantive changes, and the administrative record for this action to the State Water Resources Control Board to consider approval.
I so move, Mr. Chair.
Second.
I second, and I just wanted to say to staff that I think it was a great document, and Russian River is long overdue for some cleanup. So you've done a great job in what Board Member Sundberg stated, that not everyone being happy, probably you're in the right track. So yes, I second.
Thank you.
Deirdre, would you call the vote, please?
Board Member McKenzie?
Aye.
Board Member Sundberg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hart?
Aye.
Chair Bedoya?
Aye.
Board Member Giusti?
Aye.
Thank you.
May we take a break for the next item?
Yes, we're taking a 15-minute break. Let's get rolling then. So, item number 7, recycled wastewater in the North Coast region. Tina, welcome. Your first presentation?
It is.
Take it away.
Thank you. It's still morning, so I will say good morning, Chair Bedoya and members of the board. I'm Tina Lowe, the recycled water engineer in our MPDS and water recycling unit. I joined the North Coast Regional Board last June 2024, to fill a position created by the Water Supply Strategy Budget Change Proposal. My position is focused on implementing the recycled water actions of the Water Supply Strategy, specifically to support permitting and planning of recycled water projects. Today, it is my pleasure to present an informational item on the status of recycled water in the North Coast region. I'm joined via Zoom by Laura McClellan, who leads the recycled water unit at the State Water Board Division of Water Quality, and she's available to answer questions on statewide issues. The objectives of today's presentation are to shine a light on our recycled water program and provide an update on recycled water in the North Coast region in the context of statewide water resilience. We'll share staff activities to plan and permit recycled water projects, and then we'll look to the future to recycled water opportunities. And finally, we hope to spark a discussion during the public comment period and moving forward beyond today, and get input on how we can be most effective in water recycling, in promoting water recycling and resilience. We've contacted recycled water producers and other interested parties to encourage participation. Today's presentation will discuss statewide plans and policies. We'll get into the regulatory landscape and the regional water board role. Then we will zoom into our region and discuss the North Coast, and then we'll zoom into our region and discuss the recycled water in the North Coast regional climate change initiatives. We'll discuss regional drivers and challenges to recycled water. Then we'll get into some details regarding recycled water in the North Coast and look at how much is recycled and how and where the recycled water is used. We'll then look to the future and discuss future projects and opportunities to expand, and then summarize with key takeaways. Beneficially reusing treated wastewater has a long history in California. As drought and climate change have been at the forefront, more recent plans and policies have been developed to support and guide recycled water production and use. I'm going to go in chronological order here, and starting with the recycled water policy, which was most recently amended in 2018. The policy recognizes recycled water as a critical water supply. It directs regional water boards to implement streamlined, consistent permitting and requires volumetric reporting of wastewater and recycled water. And we'll see some data collected from this reporting in the coming slides. In 2020, the governor issued the Water Resilience Portfolio, which is the blueprint for California to cope with more extreme droughts, floods, and rising temperatures. It directs the state to diversify water supplies to strengthen local regional resilience and highlights recycled water as a sustainable, nearly drought-proof supply. Just 2 years later, in 2022, the governor's office issued the Water Supply Strategy in response to growing knowledge regarding the accelerating impacts of climate change on the state's water supply. The strategy builds on the water resilience portfolio with a sense of urgency due to projections that California could lose 10% of its water supplies by 2040 due to a hotter, drier climate. The strategy prioritizes developing new water supplies by increasing water recycling, with statewide goals to reuse 800,000 acre-feet per year by 2030 and 1.8 million acre-feet per year by 2040. For reference, an acre-feet of water is a volume that would cover an acre of land to a depth of 1 foot. This would be a football field without the end zones to a depth of 1 foot. We'll start with what recycled water is and how it is produced. Recycled water is defined in the Water Code as water which, as a result of treatment of waste, is suitable for a direct beneficial use or a controlled use that would not otherwise occur and is therefore a valuable resource. It's primarily municipal sewage that has been treated in a wastewater treatment facility and complies with recycled water regulations. So looking at the figure, we follow this blue-gray arrow. That's the influent as it enters the wastewater treatment plant, which treats the wastewater per permit requirements. If the wastewater treatment plant does not recycle, the effluent is discharged to land or surface water. Wastewater treatment plants that produce recycled water, depicted with the purple arrows, then store, pump, and distribute the recycled water out to recycled water users. There are many ways to reuse water, such as stormwater capture and industrial reuses, but the regulatory landscape around recycled water refers to the treated municipal wastewater that I just described. Recycled water can be used for potable, meaning it's part of the drinking water supply, or non-potable use, meaning it's not part of the drinking water supply. Non-potable applications include irrigation, impoundments, and individual or commercial cooling. The allowable non-potable uses and required treatment are defined in Title 22, Water Recycling Criteria, which I'll discuss in the next slide. Potable reuse can either directly or indirectly augment drinking water supplies, the main difference being whether there is a suitable environmental barrier. There is indirect potable use, which is the planned reuse of wastewater to replenish drinking water supplies with a suitable environmental barrier, such as with a groundwater recharge and reuse project. Direct potable reuse regulations recently became effective in October of 2024 and is the planned introduction of recycled water directly into a public drinking water system or into raw supply immediately upstream of a drinking water plant. This practice uses multiple phases of proven advanced treatment technologies. There's been significant media coverage recently of large water recycling projects that augment water supply, especially in the Southern California, Los Angeles area. These are potable reuse supplies. Potable reuse supplies require high levels of treatment, monitoring, and technical and financial capacity. So whether to pursue a non-potable or a potable reuse project needs to take into account these requirements and many other factors. Fortunately, communities have options on which reuse type is best suited to them. All reuse in the North Coast region is non-potable, so the remainder of this presentation will focus on non-potable uses. Continuing on with the regulatory landscape, the water boards regulate the production and use of recycled water in a manner that protects to protect public health and the environment. Recycled water regulations are provided in Title 22, Uniform Statewide Recycling Criteria, which addresses each type of recycled water use where the use involves protection of public health. Public health is protected through appropriate treatment to reduce pathogens to an acceptable level, depending on the type of use, limits of the type of uses, and use area requirements. These use area requirements are typically best management practices to keep the irrigation to the intended areas, as well as applying at an agronomic rate. Title 22 defines four levels of treatment of non-potable uses. Shown in the table are the levels in order of lowest to highest treatment level, along with just a couple of examples of allowable uses. So starting on the left of this arrow, we have undisinfected secondary, disinfected 23, disinfected 2.2, and disinfected tertiary. And the numbers on these types, on these treatment levels, disinfected 23 and disinfected 2.2, refer to the maximum concentrations allowable for total coliform bacteria. The allowable uses for each treatment level are stated in 20, and they're based on the level of public health risk or exposure for different uses. For example, disinfected tertiary recycled water is required for irrigation of public parks, while irrigation of pasture land not related to milk production can be done with recycled water of a lower level of treatment. The higher the treatment level, the less restrictions on the use. Disinfected tertiary can be used for most non-potable applications. And there is permitting around these uses. Recycled water producers must submit a Title 22 engineering report demonstrating that the project complies with regulations. And we work closely with the Division of Drinking Water during this review process. Division of Drinking Water reviews the Title 22 engineering reports, and the regional water boards then incorporate their conditions or recommendations into permits that we issue. So I think I'll pause just right here for any if there was anything not super clear on the regulatory landscape. I know it was a lot of information there.
I've got three questions. There's a 10% drop expected by 2030. Is that due to evaporation?
By 2040 is when that projected up to 10%, and that's the hotter and drier climate projections. The
2040, yes.
The air takes more. Everything will be thirstier.
Okay. And from experience in Healdsburg, there was a, due to conservation during the drought, there was a drop in production of wastewater, sewage. And so the budget, there was a budget shortfall in the city. There was not enough wastewater delivered to the municipal treatment site, and so they increased our rates because there was a shortfall. Just want to put that out there. And then a third question for watering livestock, is tertiary, secondary or tertiary allowed? Or is it not allowed?
I believe there's a case-by-case review when it is not a specifically allowable use specified in Title 22. I'm not certain about the history of Healdsburg request to use that for livestock watering.
Well, throughout our region, I'd say.
I believe it's not one of the specified uses in Title 22, so there would, I think, have to be a request and a consultation with Division of Drinking Water.
Okay.
In those kinds of cases.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So, okay, I'll keep moving forward here. Recycled water also fits within our North Coast Regional Climate Change Climate Initiatives, which are informed by state and federal climate change adaptation strategies and policies, such as using existing permitting tools and supporting regional and local planning. As our climate specialist presented in April of 2024, recycled water actions to advance climate initiatives include promoting water recycling in wastewater permitting and supporting planning and implementation of recycled water projects to enhance resilience to climate change. There are many drivers supporting recycled water, including strong policy support, as I just spoke of, to move recycled water use forward to address water supply and resilience and protect aquatic habitat. A driver that is unique to our region is a North Coast Basin Plan prohibition on point source discharges to inland surface waters with limited exceptions. When seasonal and flow discharge prohibitions are in effect, wastewater facilities have limited or no ability to discharge to surface waters. Therefore, they need to store or beneficially reuse their effluent, creating a driver for developing recycled water programs. Water recycling becomes a multi-benefit option, particularly given the irrigation demand occurs during the summer when point source discharges to inland receiving waters are prohibited. While there are drivers, there are also region-specific challenges. One is difficulty in identifying recycled water users. There are also challenges in securing funding for treatment and distribution infrastructure. And a majority of communities in the region are disadvantaged and face difficulty with technical and economic capacity to operate recycled water systems that are more complex and require more certifications to operate. Wastewater operators are certified at grades 1 through 5, with more complex systems requiring the higher grade certifications. The higher grade certifications command higher salaries, which are ongoing costs. Several facilities face challenges to recruiting and retaining these advanced operators. And if these operators leave, it affects the reliability of plant operations and delivery of recycled water. And this creates another hurdle to securing recycled water users. Now that we've talked about the drivers and challenges, let's get into our region's wastewater and recycled water data. A major source of data is from facilities reporting to the volumetric annual report, which is required by the recycled water policy. All facilities with a design flow greater than 20,000 gallons per day treating wastewater containing domestic wastewater must report. And the required data include influent, effluent, reuse, and categories of reuse. As shown on the map, 55 facilities, they're shown by the different colored dots. 55 facilities produce municipal wastewater in the region. Of these, 19 facilities, shown in the orange dots and that one lighter blue dot up at the northern part of the region, produced recycled water in 2023. So how much recycled water was produced by these 19 recycled water facilities? We have 5 years of wastewater and reuse data to provide insight into trends. From 2019 through 2023, the approximate total annual wastewater influent volume, this is wastewater entering wastewater treatment plants, varied from 40,000 acre feet per year to 55,000 acre feet per year. Annual volume reused during these 5 years varied from 21,000 to 27,000 acre feet per year. The percent reuse has been approximately 40 to 60% each year. So looking at in the statewide context, the reuse volume is smaller than some regions, particularly in Southern California, but the reuse percentage is higher than the statewide percentage, which is about 20%. We do see variation from year to year in influent volume, reuse volume, and percent reuse. And one factor is the amount of rainfall. 2019 and 2023 were wet years statewide. It's not surprising to see higher influent volumes due to influent infiltration and lower irrigation demand in wetter years. But overall, there is an increasing trend in recycled water use. Looking at where the recycled water is produced, the areas in the region with higher populations produce higher volumes of wastewater that could potentially be recycled. The maps shown here are the map from the previous slide with a zoomed-in view of the southern portion of the region. The Santa Rosa Laguna Subregional Water Reclamation Facility is the largest producer and produced 84% of the recycled water in the region. The highest five facilities produce 95% of the recycled water in the region, and they are the Santa Rosa, Windsor, Ukiah City, McKinleyville, and Healdsburg City facilities. Most recycled water is produced and used in the southern portion of the region. Recycled water uses most common in the region are geothermal energy production at the geysers, industrial application cooling towers also at the geysers, agricultural irrigation, and landscape irrigation. These photos depict recycled water uses and signage that we see in our region and in the case of irrigation throughout the state. Next, we'll look at how recycled water is used in the region. This pie chart shows the percentages of different uses in 2023, when the total reuse volume was just over 27,000 acre feet. As we previously noted, the Santa Rosa subregional facility produces 84% of the recycled water in the region. So the uses shown in the pie chart are dominated by how the recycled water produced by the Santa Rosa plant is used. Recycled water in the region is primarily used for geothermal energy production at the geysers geothermal complex, agricultural irrigation, and industrial application, mainly cooling towers. Smaller percentages were used for landscape irrigation, commercial application, golf course irrigation, and other non-potable uses such as fill stations and dust control. While geothermal energy production is a dominant use and is unique to the region, agricultural irrigation is an important and significant use in many communities. In 2023, about 6,500 acre feet of recycled water was used to irrigate agricultural areas. We looked at monitoring data from facilities producing recycled water for agricultural irrigation to better characterize this use. For fodder crops, pasture lands, and non-vineyard crops, 5,700 acre feet of recycled water irrigated 6,200 acres of fields. For vineyards, 850 acre feet of recycled water irrigated 2,700 acres of vineyards. Recycled water is a significant water supply for agricultural uses in the region and an area where we are looking for opportunities to expand. Areas like Wairika and Etna in Siskiyou County may be areas of opportunity, particularly if funding and operator capacity can be increased. Speaking of moving on to funding support is a very important factor in implementing recycled water projects. Without funding support, recycled water projects may be cost prohibitive to ratepayers. The State Water Board Division of Financial Assistance administers the Water Recycling Funding Program, which funds planning, construction, and research projects. Funding is intended for water recycling projects that offset or augment fresh or potable supplies. Over the past decade, the Water Recycling Funding Program has executed a total of $96.8 million for recycled water projects in our region. Planning projects usually involve feasibility studies and have received $1.45 million total. In the last decade, construction projects tend to involve infrastructure such as storage facilities, pump stations, and pipelines, and have higher costs. For construction projects, the Water Recycling Funding Program has executed agreements totaling $95.35 million. Other state and federal agencies also administer funding programs aimed at sustainability and infrastructure, which are priorities that aligned with recycled water. Many projects utilize a combination of funding sources. In line with state policy direction and our climate initiatives, the goal is to expand recycled water use. There are several projects in various stages of planning, expansion, or implementation. The Water Supply Strategy Plan projects list was developed as part of Water Supply Strategy Implementation and lists several projects in our region that have the potential to be operational by 2040. The Water Recycling Funding Program has executed agreements to the following planning project proponents: the City of Fort Bragg, Brook Trails Township Community Services District, which is in Mendocino County near Willits, City of Cloverdale, and McKinleyville Community Services District. Construction projects that have been awarded funding include City of Ukiah's Phase 4 project and Mendocino City Community Services District's Recycled Water Expansion Project, which aims to bring recycled water to school fields and also to provide fire protection reliability. Now that we've gone over the picture of recycled water in the region, I like to tie in the actions that we are taking as a region. We carry out our permitting responsibilities to update older permits and also permit new recycled water projects. We conduct case management by reviewing reports and inspecting production facilities and use sites. And on the broader holistic planning side, we collaborate and provide technical assistance and support funding discussions. And we plan for the future by engaging in planning studies and evaluating where wastewater may be available for future recycling. In summary, here are the key takeaways. Recycled water is a highly effective tool for water supply resilience in the face of drought and climate change. North Coast region is recycling about half its municipal wastewater, in large part due to the Santa Rosa Laguna subregional facility recycling nearly all of their treated wastewater. And there are opportunities to recycle more, but we'll need funding, technical, and regulatory support. And with that, I thank you for the opportunity to present this information item, and I'm happy to hear any questions or comments, and Laura is also available to answer questions on statewide issues.
Tina, thank you. That's a great presentation, very, very thorough. I have a few questions and a comment. What entity is tasked with analyzing the tertiary or the treated water for pharmaceuticals or PFAS? Meaning that if these substances are in that treated water, continue to stay in suspension, they're delivered to a location, do they accumulate, and will there be a problem? What entity is monitoring that?
I believe there are several entities involved in really addressing and studying and monitoring the issue of contaminants of emerging concern and pharmaceuticals. For our tertiary treated recycled water, monitoring for contaminants of emerging concern was evaluated by a scientific advisory panel. And the panel, I believe, concluded that the use of the water in that non-potable way was a lower risk, and they did not recommend monitoring from the perspective of from the requirements of a facility to recycle, from the recycling producer's responsibility to monitor. I believe there was a study focused on Region 1 contaminants of concern in the Russian River, and I believe there's ongoing concern and ongoing studies and research in this area. For the potable reuse side, Division of Drinking Water and the State Board Division of Water Quality, as well as many other entities, work together to really look at data gaps, regulatory gaps, and where more information may be needed.
I was on a tour of the geysers and asked this question. And they said the internal temperature of the wells is about 400 degrees, and they thought that these materials, these molecules, would be disassociated or would be rendered ineffective or not harmful at that temperature. The other thing I wanted to mention is that I believe the North Coast is in Regional Water Quality Control Board is involved in developing relationships with the colleges within our region to help create technicians that will work within the water treatment realm. Could you speak to that a little bit? Or Valerie, do you know? I think there were some visits to Arcata or Humboldt or Mendocino College. Talking about some.
I'm not aware of any specific partnerships related to training for wastewater operators. I will say that we conduct recruitment efforts at colleges throughout the region, and so our staff are at times in touch with students that way to talk about the types of positions available at the regional board and, our knowledge of workforce needs in general in the region. But I keep looking at other faces in the room, and I'm not seeing anyone having knowledge of specific partnership efforts about wastewater operator training.
A conversation I had with staff, one of the staff members, regarding a career fair that they attended.
Yeah, that sounds like that may be that connection with universities. In general, we acknowledge that there's a significant need for workforce development in this area in our region. We are very supportive of, any partner efforts related to, training and communicating and supporting wastewater operators in the region. I know the Russian River Watershed Association has some great efforts on that front, and we stay in touch about those, and we're, always available to support those operator communities in their professional development, but we don't have any formal partnership efforts that I'm aware of at this point.
I'm getting a look from Claudia.
Yes. It's triggering my thought process when she was mentioning that. I think the Rural Community Assistance Program or Corporation, which is RCAC, offers training opportunities for disadvantaged communities and is involved in our region in providing wastewater treatment plant operator training, and I believe it includes recycled water training as well, as long as the North Coast Resource Partnership provides some of that training. But I don't know the specific details, if it's specific to recycling or not, or if it's just wastewater treatment operator certifications. And obviously the State Water Board also has a wastewater operator certification program, but I'm not aware if it includes a training program as well.
If there's any way for us to support those programs, it would be great. Otherwise, it's an aging demographic that technicians age and term out or move on to higher paying jobs. But developing young technicians to serve in this expanding segment of water treatment is really important.
I agree, and we are currently in negotiations and waiting for funding to be provided to enter into a contract with the North Coast Resource Partnership, and this could be something we could add. I know part of that scope was to provide assistance in developing grant proposals and seeking and securing infrastructure funding, but we could also expand that to include some training opportunities, like you just mentioned right now.
You get a thumbs up from me.
Yes. Thank you.
Charles.
Hi, Charles Reed, Division Supervisor for the Point Source Control and Groundwater Protection Division. I think we would be remiss in not reminding everybody that Sacramento State has had a longstanding wastewater treatment operator program, and they've had that for decades, and they're still in existence and still training operators for wastewater plants and water treatment plants, I imagine, as well. So that they've been, I think, the main trainer of wastewater treatment operators in the state.
Thank you. Board members.
Oh, just a comment, Mr. Chair. Tina, thank you for a very thoughtful and thorough and polished presentation. I would have never guessed this was your first presentation before the board. You sounded like an old pro. And so it was really, but the details that you shared with us and the depth of your presentation was much appreciated. Thank you. Good job.
Mr. Chair, I come from the city of Rohnert Park. There had a long history in the use of recycled water, and in fact, in the pantheon of people who have been involved in encouraging such measures, one can go back to the name of the late Bill Cordham and the former mayor of Rohnert Park, Dave Ack, a chemistry professor at Sonoma State University. And they were very encouraging and, in fact, instrumental in the early utilization of recycled water in Rohnert Park and the school district. And Sonoma State University continues to be the case. The full coverage of Rohnert Park has not been completed, and in the north section of Rohnert Park, there's still an opportunity for 300 acre feet of recycled water to be utilized on the northern golf course. That being said, there's a scarcity problem with the subregional plant in Santa Rosa because of the sending of water to the geysers, and the early adopters, the farms to the west of Santa Rosa and the city of Rohnert Park are somewhat constrained. Unintended consequences of the Sonoma Marin Water Partnership leading to the reduction, as the chair said, in Healdsburg of effluent going to the subregional plant available for treatment. And so the great questions of the 1990s and capacity of that plant have never had to be answered because, in fact, water conservation at the domestic and municipal level have resulted in a decrease of the effluent load. All of that being said, I would concur with the remarks about your presentation. Well done. Very thorough coverage. And again, the question of funding raises its head. And as we find in more than one area of our interest, there are restrictions. That's why Rohnert Park has never, one of the reasons they've not been able to proceed with that final step on the northern part of the city. So thank you for your presentation, and that concludes my remarks.
I just had a question. So as recycling water gets expanded, is there ever any worry from the CSDs on taking away their ratepayers and them having like a funding problem? Have you heard anything like that?
Trying to kind of fully understand your question. So with,
I was just thinking, like he said, there's 300,000 acre feet available. Well, if it was on a golf course, the golf course would normally pay for that water. Mm-hmm. If that goes away, you know, do they have to lay people off, or is there ever a worry from a CSD that delivers water that their ratepayers are being taken away?
Oh,
It just came to my mind. I didn't know.
So whether the ratepayers that were paying for a potable supply and are now using a recycled water supply, whether that is decreasing the ratepayer base for the potable supplier.
Yeah, I just didn't know if it has that ever come up.
Not to my knowledge.
Well, that's good then.
Tina, thank you so much for your presentation. Yeah.
Thank you.
Brenda has a question.
Would I be allowed to make comments? I didn't fill a slip out yet.
I don't see why not.
I think the board should allow public comment to the extent that any member of the public is interested in commenting on this item. So I would request, well, maybe since Brenda already filled out a comment card, maybe we can just add the item number to that card. But if there's anybody else who wishes to comment that has not completed a comment card, please do complete a card and we can do those comments.
Brenda, please.
Thank you. I don't have anything prepared, but I studied this issue for many years.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I studied this issue for many years, and I had a great deal of experience, did a lot of reading on this when I was working on Santa Rosa issues. And basically, there are just maybe two comments that I think irrigating with wastewater is a great reuse of water under many circumstances. And under large parcels, it's less of a problem. There is occasionally a problem with runoff, and that's the main issue, I believe. But in urban irrigation, it became a lot more of a problem. And I had many times I went out at 6 o'clock in the morning and took pictures of irrigation with wastewater going on people who were jogging and going on pets and little kids and at park areas. And I think I haven't been tracking this for quite a while, so I did make numerous express concern about this, and I'm pretty sure Santa Rosa corrected all the issues that came up, but I'm not sure about Roner Park. But I think over that time period, they may have made the needed corrections. There's no specific numerical requirement for how much runoff could go off that they call incidental. And when you're in a park, you're way more constrained about keeping it away so it doesn't go directly on people and pets. So that was one issue of concern. And the other issue of great concern has to do with the potable, putting it into the potable supply. And I did a lot of reading about what the scientific experts are saying, and to the extent I could understand it, there was no scientist willing to state at that time that unequivocally there's a 100% safe way of using recycled water and putting it into a drinking water supply. There's just too much that is not known about many of the toxins that get into our water supply, and too little that's known about the causes of cancer and many diseases. So I would hope if I were around and someone was proposing direct potable increase with wastewater, I'd oppose it vehemently because I think it's very questionable. There may come a time when there's more certitude around it, but I don't think we're there yet. But in terms of large agriculture parcels, I think that's a great use of the recycled water. Thank you.
I think personally, so long as the material is analyzed and determined free of contaminants, then it would be reasonable to use as potable. In the vineyard use, we used to apply it, and there was great benefit in the nutrition that came with it, up to a certain point. If there's a cool spring, there's a nitrate accumulation, which causes a problem with vine shoot tip growth, and it creates if the nitrates aren't metabolized, it creates I forget the chemical name, but it was a putrescine that developed in the petiole of the leaf and would cause the leaf to fall off, ending up with a naked shoot, which when the weather warmed up, it would then metabolize it and metabolize the nitrogen accumulated, and regrowth would happen. But there's a little downside. The other downside is the pH. Usually it's 8, eight or thereabouts. And in some soils, it could cause micronutrient tie-ups or the excess availability of micronutrients. So those are the issues in agriculture that I'm aware of. And then in terms of application to golf courses and paths nearby, I think it's a timing issue. If the material if it's sprayed on parks and golf courses at night, there's less of an issue with pedestrians or vehicles. But then you go, you know, if it's stormy, if it's windy, spray's going to get carried.
Yeah, I think that's the problem, managing it in a way so that
it's
really hard to do it if it's a high intense use with more people involved or more people having contact with it. And there's like 80,000 chemicals on the market, and many of them are not regulated or studied, or not much is known. So there's just too big of an unknown factor to have people come in direct use. I know that J.K. knows a lot about this too, so he might have some other thoughts about it. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you. Laura, do you have any comments you want to make?
Thank you, Chair. My name is Laura McClellan. I'm a senior environmental scientist in the Recycled Water and Brackish Groundwater Desalination Unit in the State Water Board's Division of Water Quality. And so many of these issues are familiar to me. You may be familiar, Tina used to be in my group before she joined the North Coast Regional Board, and I'm just very pleased to see the presentation. I wanted to mention in regards to Ms. Edelman's comment about the use of recycled water for potable purposes. There have been several expert panels convened to address and examine the potential for exposure to constituents of emerging concern as well as pathogens. They have had several sets of recommendations for both treatment and monitoring to ensure that the treatment involved in potable uses undergoes significant layers of quality assurance, quality control, and redundancy within the treatment processes to ensure that pathogens are fully removed. And emerging contaminants is definitely something we have on our radar. We have a statewide constituents of emerging concern strategy to flag new chemicals that we may not be yet regulating, but may have concern for human health, as well as aquatic wildlife. And so we have processes that we are putting in place and working on fleshing out to address those concerns as we learn about them. The question is always about unknown constituents. What are we not looking for that may be present, that may have combinatory effects that may cause some sort of human health impact that is difficult to monitor for, to be aware of. And so that's why there are so many layers of redundancy and conservatism built into the regulations for treatment. So yeah, just wanted to share that perspective on how the regulations and policy were developed. We're trying to encourage recycled water as a supply. We know it's very beneficial for helping communities diversify their water supplies to be able to respond to and prepare for future droughts and water supply uncertainties. But we do know that it carries risks. And so a part of our work is also to be proactively addressing those risks and being conservative in our approaches to ensure that that human health and the environment are protected. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Laura, this question's back to you. You stated that the policy is to be on the lookout for maybe those things that aren't yet regulated that might need to be on the radar in the future to regulate, and you know, impacts to human health, and then you stated impacts to aquatic species health. Is the state only looking at aquatic species, or are they looking at the entire system, so non-aquatic species as well, in the event there's some chemical that affects them but maybe not aquatic? I mean, is the state only looking at aquatic?
Yeah, so there has been an expert panel that we convened a couple of years ago to look at impacts from CECs broadly, constituents of emerging concern broadly, to the waters of the state. So the focus is on the waters of the state, so we may not be necessarily looking at, in that case, the application of water to land and impacts to species that may occur from that. But yeah, I think it's an area that there frankly just isn't a whole lot of literature or data on. And so when we convene these experts to review the available data, the available literature, the tools that they have to work with is there's a kind of a paucity of data and information on a lot of impacts there.
Thank you.
Laura, other countries such as the Netherlands have been really ahead of the curve in technology. And is there a sharing of ideas? Does the state make excursions to learn technologies and see what other people are constructing or building to better treat water and or better analyze the constituents of emerging concern throughout the world?
Yeah, so our expert panel, one of the panelists is from Germany, and he's very tapped into what the European Union is doing on emerging contaminants and has been really helpful in providing that perspective. Unfortunately, state workers were not able to travel often. And so, yeah, would love to go to the Netherlands. But no, yeah, there is a lot of collaboration that occurs across state lines with our colleagues in other states who are working on recycled water. Some of the issues they encounter, I think California is far out ahead of many other states in the types of uses that it puts recycled water to, and our work on emerging contaminants. And yeah, so the work that the Netherlands has done, we have a small research program where we fund research to examine challenges in recycled water use in the state, with a goal of advancing the recycled water use in the state by addressing research gaps, knowledge gaps, emerging treatment technologies, and the like. And so through that research program, that's sort of the avenue that we use to remain tapped into what is going on elsewhere. We have a grant kicking off in about a month with the Water Research Foundation to prioritize and advance the highest priority research needs for the state. And so they're going to undertake an exercise of looking really holistically with input from industry, academia, regulators, members of the public, of what the highest priority needs are for the state. And then we will be funding research to address those needs. And so through efforts like that, that's how we connect with what is going on elsewhere.
Thank you very much. Alex, your hand is up. Do you have a question? Okay. Well, Tina and...
I just failed to lower it from earlier. Sorry.
Okay. Tina and Laura, thank you so much for your presentation and your information. Very much appreciated.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to item 8. Valerie, Executive Officer's Report.
Thank you. I do want to really highlight and emphasize the written executive officer's report this month, in addition to the enforcement report, which is always part of the EO's report, and I think rightly got some good airtime during the enforcement update yesterday. In addition to that recurring item in the EO's report, I want to highlight both of the articles in this report. It's sort of our basin planning edition of the EO's report. First, there's an article from Brian McFadden regarding prohibitions and the importance of the basin plan. And the reason I really want to highlight this is that so often our articles are about a particular project and our board items are about kind of specific focused efforts. And I think this article is unusual and really important because it's a little bit more kind of on foundational knowledge about the regional board's authorities and the mechanisms that we have to carry out those authorities. So if you haven't had the chance to take a look at that article, I strongly encourage it. You know, the Russian River Pathogen Action Plan that you all just adopted includes a prohibition that's a really important tool for the regional board. And other upcoming projects will include similar measures. And so I think this article is just a really excellent foundational information related to those kinds of projects. And then the other article, thanks to Lisa Bernard for putting together the update on triennial review project status. This was in response to when the board adopted the triennial review, there were requests for regular updates on the status of these projects. And so this article is a response to that request. It's something that we plan to do hopefully once or twice a year throughout the triennial review period, just to provide updates on what's happening with those projects and what's coming up next and projected timelines. So that article is the kind of thing that could serve as a helpful reference over time to look back at if there are any questions. You know, staff are always available for questions, but this is a great resource both for board and public. So wanted to highlight those and also pause to see if you have any questions. We do have Lisa and Catherine here if board members have any questions about status of triennial review items or anything else.
Board members, any questions for Valerie or Lisa or Catherine or Tina?
No, just a recognition when I was reading the Outstanding National Resource Waters update. I wasn't a big supporter of it at the time. I still have my questions about it, but I'm glad to see that progress is being made and that that things are moving forward. I'm looking forward to an MOU coming out and hearing more about it when it's timely. So even a project that I had my concerns about, I'm happy to see progress on it. So thanks for sharing that. Thank you.
Alex?
Is this a time we can request future items?
Unless there are no other comments on the executive officer's report, Jake, did you have something?
No, I was getting ready for future items.
All right, let's go with future items, Alex.
Thank you, Chair. My request would be that I would like for council to prepare a presentation for this board and Region 1 staff, covering what comes under the definition of public trust resources, what are the legal authorities of this board and staff under that definition, and what are their responsibilities? You know, what latitude do we have to decide prioritization under public trust doctrine? Those are topics I'd like to see it in a presentation from council to this board and to staff.
Okay. Message received. Yep. Thanks, Alex.
Board members, any other items that you'd like to see brought up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we touched on it in the last presentation, where all of a sudden we had someone from, I believe, from the State Board talking about residues of contaminants in water. And I'd be interested in hearing from a representative of the State Board what the status is on their under the Safe Drinking Water Act, or it's a California equivalent, in terms of identification of contaminants and at what levels they are held to be biologically significant. I think we're all aware that we are, in fact, as residents in the 21st century, exposed to synthetic chemicals in every aspect of our life. So as far as I'm concerned, as a past regulator of pesticides with US EPA, it's really a question of what's the biological significance of these contaminants, and how does the state of California propose to regulate them? The chair made reference to standards in the Netherlands, and definitely in the European Economic Community, their strenuous regulations in effect. So that's a topic I would like to have addressed at some point in the future. I'm not saying it's a matter of urgency, but it was interesting how it emerged through Ms. Edelman's comments, and then the reaction from the State Board representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jake. Any other comments? All right. Well, thank you all for a great meeting, a couple days of meetings. The next meeting will be 6 p.m. Wednesday, October 8th, 2025, at Crescent City, location to be determined, and then 9 a.m. October 10th, Friday, 2025, in Eureka.
Wairika.
Wairika.
It's called the driving meeting.
Yeah, right. On the road.
Okay, so this meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.